Inside the Game with Pat Williams is a pre-recorded show.
Folks, it's time for Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams. Every weekend, we get to talk sports with some really interesting people. Always so pleased when you join us. So is Jeff Sennis. He does our engineering. Andrew Hurd Liska produces the show. And I want to introduce you to Amy Card. She's written a book, The Tiger Bells, Olympic Legends from Tennessee State. Amy, nice to catch up with you, and welcome to Orlando.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
How did this book come about? Why is it important?
Well, I knew about the Tiger Bells growing up. I grew up in a track family. I wasn't a runner myself, but I got dragged to all the events, all the things. And I grew up in Nashville, where the Tiger Bells are from, and I just always knew of them as the epitome of athletic achievement. And as I got older and moved into the world, I realized that other people didn't know about them. And I felt like they really deserved to have their story shared.
Well, your first chapter is simply called Origins. Fill us in.
So it's really just the beginning of how the Tiger Bells got started. Ed Temple is their coach. He was their coach for a long period of time, over 40 years. And he was an athlete at Tennessee State. And he was looking for a job after school, and he got offered to coach the women's track team. And, you know, it wasn't something that he had thought of. He wasn't necessarily opposed to it, but he had the opportunity, and he took it. And once he started working with this team, he never quit. He never did anything else for his entire career, and that was a storied career, a legendary career he had.
Then you move to the next topic called growing a team. What's going on now?
So this is all about recruitment. So we're talking about May Fags, who was the origin. She was the real kind of spark to the team. She was already, by the time she came to Tennessee State, she was an Olympic athlete. She had been to the 1948 and just had gone to the 1952 Olympics in Helsinki. And she had gotten a gold medal at the 1952 Olympics for that part of the really leading the relay team there. And then when she came on to the Tennessee State team, she brought a team with her, not just because, you know, she was really bringing them along, but just from her reputation, it was just, you know, bringing that star onto the team. And she also brought her knowledge that Temple didn't even have. He didn't know necessarily how to run on an indoor track because they didn't have one at Tennessee State. And so she was coming with that experience, and she was able to share as much with the coach as the coach was to share with her. So they really made a great team and started off. And then it just kind of goes into their recruitment practices, how he found the talent, that they didn't just come to him, you know, through May 5, so that's part of it. But he would go to the relays at Tuskegee and recruit talent. He was he had friends that were in high schools around the South, and they would kind of be looking out for him for you know, special runners, and they saw special athletes coming up. And one in particular was Wilma Rudolph. She's probably the most famous of the Tiger Bells. She's the one most people would have heard of. But he actually would, on the weekends, just to pick up some extra money, he would referee high school basketball games. And he found Wilma Rudolph refereeing one of those basketball games in Clarksville. So he was kind of looking anywhere and everywhere and gathering his team.
My guest is Amy Card. She's written the book, The Tiger Bells. Amy, the next topic, the 1956 Nationals. And then you come right behind that with a chapter simply called Melbourne.
That's right. So at this point, the team is getting strong. You know, they're gathering a good group of talent. They're young still. But they have that leader in May Fags, and, you know, they have a very young, still in high school, Wilma Rudolph, and still in high school, Willie White, both 16 years old on the team. And so they go to Nationals They had at the time really, really minimal funding allowed for their team. So they take two station wagons up to the Nationals in New Jersey, and they stayed. Well, they had enough money, Coach Temple says, to only make one trip. So they did the Nationals and the Olympic Trials all in one trip. The Olympic Trials was shortly after the Nationals, and he was assuming with the quality of his team that he was going to have some people qualify for the team. And so he, after they had their Nationals performance, which they did completely outperform expectations, they really blew everybody away with the Nationals performance, he brought all of the team to his parents' house to stay for a few days in between. This was really, he was just a young man, you know, trying to do everything he could to get, you know, the opportunities available for these young women. And so then they go to the Olympic trials in D.C., and six women on that team qualified for the Olympics, more than even he expected. So that included Wilma Rudolph, it included Willie White, both 16 years old, and then they go to Melbourne. So Wilma and Willie, before they had joined the Tennessee State team, had never left their hometown. This was something unfathomable to them. They came because they knew they were great runners. They knew they could, you know, beat everybody that was around them. But they weren't even really aware of the thing called the Olympics. It's not like now where it's just in the culture. It wasn't televised. It was just something that it never occurred to them that they could aspire to this. And so when they heard about it, Willie White's motivation to being in the Olympics was just so that she could get away from home for, you know, it was just a new adventure that she was going to be able to have. And she would have to, in the summer, her father, her grandfather, actually, who was raising her, would have her work in the fields in Greenwood, Mississippi. And she lived in Money, Mississippi, you know, where Emmett Till was murdered. And he, so that was, you know, the year before the Olympics that happened. And so she didn't want to go back in the field. She wanted to get away as fast as she can. And that was her motivation for making the Olympic team, wasn't just the Olympics wasn't a thing for her. It was really just having this other experience and being able to stay away from home. So, and it opened up a whole new world for them. It just, for them to go across the world, you know, Willie White said, you know, it was the first time they had been in an airplane. And, you know, she said, I went to sleep over the water. I woke up over the water. It just, you couldn't even imagine. That experience was so new, and then they got there, and you know they were living in the Jim Crow South, where their lives were very separated, and then they realized that they could be friends with people of different races and ethnicities as they were, and they could, you know, eat together and share rooms together and dance together and all the things. So it just, for all of them, even more than the athletic accomplishments that they were able to, you know, the athletic achievement that they were able to reach. It was just the experience. It's opening up worlds of possibilities for them. But in that Olympics, Wilma Rudolph earned a bronze medal as a part of the relay team, and Willie White earned a silver medal on her own for the long jump. So sorry about that. That is my alarm for
Amy.
That was my alarm for, yeah, sorry about that. That was my alarm,
Amy,
for this conversation.
Amy Card is our guest. Amy, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but you do a whole chapter in the middle of your book simply called Wilma and Willie. Tell me about that chapter.
So Wilma and Willie were both, they were kind of polar opposites, but they were so much alike. So they were both the ones that were 16 years old that went to the 1956 Olympics. But when they came back from the Olympics, their lives took really different. They were both in high school, and after the Olympics, they come back and have to go back to high school. And their lives took really different routes at that point. Willie White was motivated. It was all about what she was going to be able to accomplish, because her whole world had opened up. And Wilma Rudolph came back, and she was kind of queen of her high school. You know, she'd gone to the Olympics and she started dating the, you know, captain of the football team, and they were just, you know, big people on campus. And so Wilma actually ended up getting pregnant, and so she had to take some time off of her sport and kind of reevaluate where she thought her life, you know, would she stay home? Would she, you know, continue with athletics? For her, it was kind of a social awakening. She was growing up and deciding who she was going to be as a person. But with Willie, she was deciding that she was going to really dig in, and it was all about athletics for her. But when Willie came to Tennessee State, she really came with a lot of attitude. And Coach Temple, just, you know, deservedly so, she was scrappy. She'd had a rough childhood. And so she really butted heads with Coach Temple, who really, in order to manage all of these talents and personalities, he had a really strict set of rules. And Willie didn't like rules at all. So while Wilma had some, you know, social challenges, and she was trying to figure out what she was going to do with her life, she was also kind of like the ideal superstar, really sweet. She was pliable. You know, she would do what people, she was coachable. But Willie was hard charging and determined, but also butted heads with the coach. So they have kind of their own tensions that they, and their own challenges, but meanwhile, both being very young still and still trying to figure out where their lives were going to go.
My guest is Amy Card. She has written the book, The Tiger Bells, Olympic Legends from Tennessee State. We have another segment with Amy. I want you to stay with us here. It's Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams. And this is AM 950 and FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. Stay with us. We'll be right back. My guest is Amy Card. She's written the book, The Tiger Bells, Olympic Legends from Tennessee State. Amy joins us from snowy, cold Boston. Amy, let me get back on track now. We jumped ahead on that Wilma and Willie chapter, but you've talked about the 1956 Nationals. You talked about the chapter you did on Melbourne. And then you do two chapters called Beginning Again, Blood, Sweat, and Tears. What's going on at this point?
So this is really about the training methods that Coach Temple had. People joke about how strict he was and say that they don't think it would actually be allowed today. But he really he had a strict discipline. His coaching philosophy was really focusing on the fundamentals and being overly prepared, and, you know, taking your, even a sprinter should practice with the distances, and because, you know, you need to put everything into that 100 yards that you would put into a mile. So his training was, it was really tough. He had a boot camp in the summer for everyone, and, you know, hot Tennessee summer, you know what that's like, humid. So they would get up at 5 a.m, and then they would have another, you know, mid-morning practice, and then they would have an afternoon in the roll, you know, heat practice. So they had 3 practices a day. They ran for the first 2 weeks, about 6 miles each practice. So in each day, they would run about 18 miles. And then after the first 2 weeks, then they would get onto the track and they would go through painstaking details about, you know, the start, and then they have something really complicated, like the relay where you have the baton passing and staying in the lanes and all of the just fundamentals that you just have to practice so many times so that it's just routine. And even when they get nervous and meet, and even if something goes wrong, their body just knows what to do. So that was really what he believed in. That's really, what they did, but you know, they were young women, and so they were always trying to get out of some of the heavy lifting and cutting corners. And so there are some stories there about how they would, you know, get around the corner where he can't see and try to slack off because they think he's not paying attention, and then they come up over the hill and he's sitting there with his binoculars, and then they have to go around again. They have stories where, you know, they'll have issues with an injury, like an ingrown toenail or something that you think is not just a huge thing, but it can be a major thing for an athlete, and how they're going to handle that, how they're going to manage that. And they may think they want to do something, but if the coach says you need to do something else, they have to listen. So it was all really digging into the fundamentals of how he created that team. And also not just the hard stuff, but how they learn to lean on each other through that hard stuff, you know, how they learn with those challenges, how they get through them. And it's not individually, it's each other pulling each other along on those heavy, hot, you know, heavy, hot days. One of the things, the reason why the word heavy came to mind is because they had to practice in high top basketball shoes while they were doing that long distance running, just to make it a little bit harder, you know, just to make, and then when they got in their, you know, track shoes, then it was light, it was easy. So it was all the little tricks and things that Coach Temple did to really, with their training, that made this team stand out more than all of their competition.
Amy Card talking about the Tiger Bells. Then comes this topic, and it's a question. What does it take?
Yeah, so one of my favorite quotes from Coach Temple, it kept me going through this, the long years of working on this project here, is just when he would find somebody that had that special thing in them, he just knew. He knew they had some kind of spark, that extra quality that people always talk about that's just not quite definable. But he had a quote that he would use that always came to mind for me. He said, "I'm tired is not the time to quit. I'm tired is the time that you dig in and you find that thing within yourself that's going to keep you going." And so that is, it's all about that. It's all about defining, you know, recognizing that spark in other people, but also finding that in yourself. So that's really what that's about. And how he motivated the team and how, what they were all about.
On the road, and then you do a chapter called Russia. What's going on at that point?
So on the road is about their challenges when they would travel, because, you know, through the Jim Crow South, there were lots of challenges for an HBCU team, all black team. And Russia was in 1958. After they had gone to the Olympics, in 1956, the team goes to the Olympics, but the coach doesn't go with them because he's still a young coach. He's never coached a national team before. And even though he has, you know, a good chunk of the runners, he wasn't considered as a possibility for the national coach. But in 1958 in Russia, they weren't in Russia yet, but in 1958, when they go to the nationals, what was on the line for the U.S. national team was that they were going to have an opportunity to run against Russia. And this was, you know, tensions were high between the U.S. and Russia in 1958. And the country, for propaganda purposes on both sides, would be really interested in making the U.S. team show itself to its, you know, strongest. And they weren't really considering the women's team to be able to compete against the Russians, because the Russians were basically state-sponsored athletes. They had, you know, the country was highly motivated for their performance, and they would choose their athletes carefully among the entire population and would train them specifically just for that task. And meanwhile, they're, you know, up against whoever happens to be running in the U.S. And so they really had a lot more confidence in their men's team than the women's. And so they weren't sure that the women should be going on this trip, but they decided that let's give them a chance. And so the Tiger Bells were trying out when they competed for the national meet. They were trying out to see if they could make this national team to go to Russia. And, you know, of course, they were on a roll. They had their strongest team ever, and they just blew away the competition. And they made 8 people on that one team. They all came from the Tiger Bells, this one little school in Tennessee. And so Coach Temple was looking at what he was doing. He was making up. I mean, there were other people on the U.S. team, but the sprinters were the things. They were the kind of showcase athletes. They were the ones that everybody wanted to look at, and all the sprinters were Tennessee State Tiger Bells. And so Coach Temple, he knew one of the people that was on the administration for the AAU who was running the national meet, and he said that he wanted to be considered to be the coach, and if he wasn't, he'd be bringing all of his athletes back to Nashville with him. And so they took him seriously. They took him at his word, and Frances Kozubski, she was the administrator that he knew, she went to bat for him, and he got selected to be the coach for the team. That was the first time a Black man had ever been coached for the national team at all. And so he got to go with the team. So that was the first time that they were able to go with their own coach, and it gave them just a level of confidence and achievement that they were able to perform against the Russians, and the sprinters beat the Russians. And so they defied all expectations, and the men's team was expected to do well, but the women's wasn't, and they were able to prove that women can perform and they can run in these circumstances. So that was what the Russia event was about, and they got to go behind the armed curtain. It was the first time that a U.S. team had been able to do that, and so their experiences there were pretty incredible. I mean, they got to see a lot of things that many people haven't.
Amy, I want to jump to the end of the book. There are 2 chapters at the end. We have about 2 minutes left. Homecoming and Legacy are your last 2 chapters. Tell us what you write there.
Yeah, so after the 1960 Olympics, it was really where the book culminates with, an outstanding performance by the entire team at the 1960 Olympics. And the homecoming and the legacy is all about what happens when the team comes home, and, how are they celebrated, and have we now achieved, can we recognize that women can compete at this level, and can we see their achievement? And the legacy of the Tiger Bells is really what they've done in their lives going forward. It's an incredible group of women, not only for what they achieved at this event and throughout these events, but also what their lives have been about. When I was interviewing Coach Temple before he passed away, I was so honored to be able to do that. But I asked him what he wanted people to know most about the Tiger Bells. And for him, it wasn't about the achievements that they made on the track. It was about their lives. He said what he wanted people to know most is that all of his Olympians had graduated from college. So for him, it was just about lifting people up to that level. And I also hope that people take away from their legacy the power of a team and the power of working together. So that's pretty much what the homecoming and the legacy are about.
Folks, my guest has been Amy Card, author of The Tiger Bells. What a great topic, great story. Olympic legends from Tennessee State. You're listening to Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams. We have more right here on AM 950 and FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. I want to introduce you to Edwin Henderson. He lives in the Washington, D.C. area. Founding president and director of the Tinner Hill Heritage Foundation. And he's the author of The Grandfather of Black Basketball, The Life and Times of Dr. E.B. Henderson. Edwin, welcome to Orlando. Yeah. So glad to have you with me. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me.
So who was Dr. E.B. Henderson? Tell us.
Well, if you buy my book, you'll find out. But let me just get, he is the man who introduced basketball for the first time on a wide-scale organized basis to the African-American community.
How did it come up? How did it come about, Edwin? Where was he, and when was this? I'd love to hear the background.
In 1904, he had finished teachers college here in Washington, and it was suggested by a woman who was the first African American to receive the certification to teach physical education in the country, Miss Anita Turner. Suggested to him that he go to Harvard to the Dudley Sargent School of Physical Training, which was held at Harvard, and this is 1904. So this is when basically physical education was a relatively new subject matter in the public schools. During that first year in 1904, he was introduced to the fundamentals of basketball. And he learned the game, and he brought it back to Washington, D.C., where he became the first African-American male to be certified to teach physical education in the country. And he introduced the sport to his classes, to his physical education classes, in the Washington, D.C. colored school system. It was segregated schools in Washington, and that's where he taught for 50 years, from 1904 until 1954.
Did he know Dr. James Naismith?
No, but I don't know that he knew him, but the Dudley Sargent was associated with Springfield College, and that's where the game was started, and that's where the game began. By 1904, Naismith was at the University of Kansas.
Yes.
And he was the first basketball coach at the university, but his predecessor had a much better record than he did, even though he started the game.
Yes.
It did not transfer to his coaching.
Edwin Henderson is our guest. He's talking about his grandfather, the grandfather of black basketball. You open your book with a chapter called Sunrise, Where We Begin. What are you writing there, Edwin?
Well, the first chapter is my grandfather was born in Southwest Washington, D.C., to working-class parents who were born into slavery. And E.B. Henderson's parents, his father's family, his grandmother was born on the Fitzhugh Plantation in Fairfax County, which is just across the border into Virginia. And she was sold down south into slavery after she had run away. And the way the law was at the time, she was to be sold down south, ended up on a plantation in Vicksburg, Mississippi. Mm. And after the Battle of Vicksburg, she made her way back to Washington. Settled in Southwest Washington, D.C., got a loan from the Freedmen's Bureau and opened a store. And so the first chapter is genealogical, mostly talking about his ancestry, his native indigenous ancestry, as well as his enslaved African ancestry as well.
Edwin, then you moved to the Black Mecca, Washington, D.C., 1861. To 1904 and beyond. I want to hear about this.
Okay. Most people don't realize that Washington, D.C. was the place where the enslaved people tried to get to, because here they had what was called contraband camps. In other words, there were camps that were set aside to house African Americans that were formerly enslaved. The men were encouraged to join the U.S. Colored Troops, of which over 200,000 did and fought for their freedom in the Civil War. The women and children were put to work. The women, the children were put in schools. The women were assigned to cooking and cleaning and sewing and things like that. But Washington, D.C. was a very special place in that it was always a place that was safe harbor for formerly enslaved people as they were on their way to places like Philadelphia and Canada. A lot of people associate the Mecca for blacks as Harlem. But Harlem really didn't open up for blacks until around 1904.
Mm-hmm.
Very few blacks lived in Harlem until 1904 due to the speculation that the subway was going to go further north. And then when it didn't, speculators had built properties and they had to rent them out. The other thing that was the Mecca was Chicago and other places further north, but that was associated with the Great Migration and the Industrial Revolution that was taking place around the turn of the century. But between the beginning of the Civil War and the turn of the 20th century, Washington, D.C. was seen as a very attractive place for African Americans to live because there was a growing population. There were public schools where they could go get an education, and there was work.
Edwin Henderson is with us. We're talking about the grandfather of black basketball. There's a chapter in your book early, M Street High School, An Introduction to Washington's Black Elites. What's that about, Edwin?
Okay. E.B. Henderson was basically from a working class family. Mm-hmm. But his mother taught him to read and write at a very young age. Matter of fact, when they lived in Pittsburgh for a short stint, there's a chapter about that as well.
Mm-hmm.
E.B. Henderson, my grandfather, was paid a quarter to read to a teacher at his elementary school's fourth grade students because he was so advanced in his education. M Street was the academic high school, and it was, bar none, the best high school in the country, black or white. Many of the teachers there had doctorate degrees, but could not work in many of the industries where the expertise was because of segregation. And therefore, people like Carter G. Woodson, people like Anna J. Cooper, Mary Church Terrell and people like that taught at the M Street High School. And the curriculum, you know, included Latin and Greek and other such things like that. So, there was a Armstrong Technical High School as well, but M Street was the academic high school. And there was a science curriculum, and then there was and many of the students that went to M Street, later Dunbar High School, would graduate and go to Ivy League colleges further north.
Edwin, as we move deeper into the book, there's a chapter called Basketball Games Begin in Washington, 1907. And then that leads to the next topic, bringing home the title, Colored Basketball World Championship 1908. What's happening?
Okay. Now, there are some people like Claude Johnson and Bob Cuska to say that E.B. Henderson introduced basketball in 1907. Actually, according to E.B. Henderson himself, he introduced the sport in 1904. A championship was started between the teams of New York And the teams of the league that my grandfather started, the first athletic league for African Americans, called the Interscholastic Athletic Association of Middle Atlantic States. And it included teams in everything from North Carolina all the way up to New Jersey. And but my grandfather, he started his league in 1906. In New York, the athletic clubs where African Americans participated started a league called the Olympian Athletic League, the OAL, in 1907. And shortly thereafter, they negotiated a championship in the sport of basketball between the two leagues.
We've got a guest named Edwin Henderson who is with us. We're talking about his book, The Grandfather of Black Basketball, The Life and Times of Dr. E.B. Henderson. We've got to take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our chat with Edwin Henderson, talking about his memories of his grandfather in this book that he has written. Next topics, for example, Mr. Henderson's early published work, Spalding Official Handbook, The Henderson's Move to Falls Church, Virginia, The Suburban Life. And then there's Protest in the Nation's Capital. And here's an interesting chapter coming up, The Rise of Professional Sports in Washington, D.C., Horse Racing in the District of Columbia. Stay with us. I'm your host, Pat Williams. It's Inside the Game, and this is AM 950 and FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. We will be right back. Edwin Henderson is my guest. We're talking about his book, The Grandfather of Black Basketball, The Life and Times of Dr. E.B. Henderson. Tell me more about Mr. Henderson's early published work, Spalding Official Handbook, and what's happening at this point. It's 1910 to 1913, Ed.
Yes. E.B. Henderson was at Harvard. He rubbed shoulders and networked with a number of people, including a Mr. James Sullivan, who was over the AAU and also the Spalding Handbooks. One of the things that E.B. Henderson did was he was encouraged by Mr. Sullivan to start his own league, because the AAU was segregated and it would not allow black teams to participate in competitions against the other white teams that were part of the AAU. Additionally, and I have the letters between from James Sullivan, where my grandfather wrote to him and asked to write a annual booklet at the auspices of his league, the Interscholastic Athletic Association of Middle Atlantic States. In that is the first Spalding handbook, which had pictures of black athletes and black teams in it, all along the Eastern Seaboard, as well as the HBCUs. This is credited as being the first chronicling of African-American participation in sports. And E.B. Henderson, he was the editor, and he wrote to all of these entities and asked for their photos and their records and information about their leagues and their teams, which he published in the Spalding Handbook between 1910 and 1913.
Edwin, the word protest comes up moving towards the latter part of your book. Protest in Virginia, the NAACP's first rural branch, and then protest in the nation's capital. What's that all about?
Well, my grandfather was an avid civil rights activist stemming from the fact that his wife, my grandmother, was a member of the 15th Street Presbyterian Church in Washington, D.C.
Mm.
The pastor there was Francis Grimke. But Francis Grimke's brother was Archibald Grimke, and he was the founder of the Washington, D.C. chapter of the NAACP in 1912. And so they joined that chapter in 1912. But when he moved out here to Virginia, there was a ordinance that was passed in the town where he was living in Falls Church, Virginia, that would have made African Americans restricted to a certain part of town in one district, and there were three other districts where black people would not be allowed to go after sundown. Okay, these are known as sundown towns. Okay, I mean, being in Florida, there were probably several sundown towns there as well. And you better not be caught after dark in a sundown town if you were black.
Mm.
And so he called together a group of nine pillars of the community, and they formed a group called the Colored Citizens Protective League. They wrote a letter to W.E.B. Du Bois asking to form a chapter of the NAACP here in this small town and ask for resources to help them in their endeavor to fight this injustice. Well, the town went ahead and passed the ordinance, after which E.V. Henderson sued the town, which created an injunction on the ordinance, so it couldn't be enforced. He called the judge to come out and look at the district that had been created. And the judge decided he wasn't going to rule on the case because there was a similar case coming before the U.S. Supreme Court. And in 1917, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in a case entitled Warley versus Buchanan. And the decision was that making such ordinances restricting the ownership of property in districts of the town and creating sundown town was unconstitutional. And therefore, the town could not enforce the ordinance which they had passed. Additionally, my grandmother, who was also active as a civil rights leader, was a teacher and a principal at the local school here in Falls Church Colored School. And after 23 years of raising money and trying to get them to build a better facility, one that had running water and indoor toilets and central heat like the white schools did here in Falls Church, he decided to do a disparity study to show how separate was purely unequal. And she shamed them into actually building her the first modern public school for blacks in Fairfax County. Additionally, E.V. Henderson advocated against segregation in sports competitions within the AAU, picketing arenas, the U-Line Arena in Washington, as well as the Washington Redskins in the 60s, in the 50s and the 60s. But he also was involved in the protest against the National Theater and the effort to get Marian Anderson to sing at the Lincoln Memorial and then finally at Constitution Hall.
Edwin Henderson is our guest. Edwin, I don't want to run out of time, but I want to jump all the way to the epilogue. It's called Resurrecting E.B. Henderson. I want to hear what you're writing there.
Well, when my wife and I decided that we were going to nominate my grandfather to the Basketball Hall of Fame, we wrote up a 138-page booklet that we submitted, and we got no response back, and so we contacted the archivist there at the Hall of Fame, And he said nobody knew who he was. So we realized that nobody cracked the cover. And so what we did was we did a 7-minute video and burned it to DVD and sent that up as our nomination packet.
Mm-hmm.
You may not want to go through 138 pages, but surely you can watch a video for 7 minutes,
mm-hmm.
we thought. And then the next year after that, we got footage from the Today Show where Brian Gumbel was interviewing Arthur Ashe. And see, my grandfather wrote The Negro in Sports at the behest of Dr. Carter G. Woodson, the father of black history. And Arthur Ashe had just written the book Hard Road to Glory, about African-American participation in athletics.
Mm-hmm.
And Brian Gumbel asked him, well, why did you choose this topic? Surely this has been done before. And on the Today Show, Arthur said, yes, the first one to do it was Dr. Edwin Henderson.
Mm.
And so we got that footage, and it wasn't cheap getting footage from the Today Show. And we put that into the video and then sent that up to the Hall of Fame.
Mm.
Well, little by little, we wore them down. Manny Jackson, who was the owner of mm-hmm. the Harlem Globetrotters, became chairman of the Hall of Fame, and he instituted a direct elect category for African-American pioneers around 1912. And then in 1913, E.B. Henderson was inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame under that category. And then just recently, early last year in 2023, a statue was erected of E.B. Henderson in Washington at the University of District of Columbia. And now we have the book.
So how do you...
So little by little, yes. we are pushing the story. This is a 20-year effort that I've been involved in, trying to get my grandfather his just due.
So how does that make you feel with all this happening, Edwin?
Well, it's not like it's an overnight success, but I'm very happy to see that we're getting some movement on this. Additionally, I was able to meet Adam Silver up at an event in Cambridge back in October. The basketball coach at Harvard, Tommy Amaker,
yes.
Hosted an event called The Breakfast Club. And he allowed me a couple of minutes to talk about E.B. Henderson and my book. And after that, the commissioner said that they would help to promote the book, and I've been in discussions with the NBA over the last several months in order to try to promote the book in a proper and respectable way.
Edwin, we've got about a minute. Tell me at the end, Sunset, Retiring to Tuskegee. What are you writing there?
Well, my grandfather, the last 12 years of his life, we lived under the same roof together in Tuskegee when my father was director of the George Washington Carver Research Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And every summer, you know, we spent at Highland Beach, which is another town as well, where he had a summer home, and my mother inherited her grandfather's home there as well, and we always spent our summers there. So I always spent my summers with my grandfather, and then the last 12 years of his life, we lived under the same roof together. And he was a great influence. He was such a gentle and charismatic guy with a great sense of humor, and I'm hoping that that comes across in the book in some form and way, because I wanted to give him dimension. I wanted to give him life. I did not want him to just be out there as a set of facts and accomplishments.
Edwin Henderson has been our guest, author of The Grandfather of Black Basketball, The Life and Times of Dr. E.B. Henderson. Thanks so much for joining us here for Inside the Game. I'm your host, Pat Williams. We'll be back next weekend for more. Look forward to having you with us here on AM 950 and FM 94.9, The Answer in Orlando. Have a wonderful week ahead. See you next weekend.
Inside the Game with Pat Williams is a pre-recorded show.